koutou. My name is Elizabeth Collins and welcome to NZ Vegan Podcast episode 130. It's been about 3 months since I've done a podcast. I've had a crazy month, a completely unexpectedly crazy month. I was about to do a podcast in response to all of the new debates that are happening out there in the community, which are becoming more prominent. As we predicted a few years ago, the dialogue has changed. The dialogue is changing, and it is what I mean by that is the movement and the general public and the world, in terms of any discussion about animals' rights or non-human animals, the discussions are about what they should be about. They're starting to happen. They're starting to be about what they should be about. Outside the movement and in the realm of the general public advocacy, the discussion is being more focused on use, and I see evidence of that every day when I read a newspaper article. I see like that talks about animal treatment or some new, you know, welfarist expose or whatever. There are people, vegans, who are questioning animal use and saying, who are challenging it and saying this animal use is wrong, you know, which is great because you never used to see that. So that's fantastic. And veganism is being more and more talked about by vegans, thank you, finally, to other people. Within the realms of the big, messy, pathetically crazy, sort of out of control welfareist animal movement, there is now discussion more about challenging welfareism rather than, there are more new vegans. Because of the vegan movement, there are more new vegans, number one. Because there are more new vegans who are entering into a vegan movement, there are, and or at least who are entering into a atmosphere of open debate and open discussion about the detriment of welfare and the speciesism and the problems with all of this welfareist advocacy, they're not sort of just, that's not the first thing that they see. There are some vegans who find the abolitionist approach straight away. So, you know, everything's changing, inevitably. We knew it would. You cannot stop all fantastic ideas, and it's wonderful. So positive. You know, you have to be positive. I mean, there's still such a long way to go, and you could focus on all the negative if you wanted, but let's focus on the positive. It's very palpable difference. And people who are coming, you know, I'm going to sound like I don't want to be one of those boring people who say, well, you know, back in my day, because I'm only a new vegan. I only went vegan 8 years ago now. And, you know, I'm new to social justice activism. If you think about it, it's only been sort of six or seven years that I really started getting going, being an activist or a voice or whatever you want to call it, trying to actually advocate, right? It's very small amount compared to so many people. But I still do feel like there are some people who are new and then they don't actually realize what it was like 5 years ago, and they're complaining, and I'm like, you have no idea how much better it is than 5 years ago. In terms of the dialogue, in terms of the amount of abolitionists, and in terms of the amount of vegans and veganism, in terms of the, you know, the public dialogue about it. So yay, that's fantastic. I was going to do a podcast all about single issue campaigns, like a completely dedicated podcast about it, because that's actually been a debate. They have these big festivals in England every year. They don't seem to be the same kind of thing as the so-called animal rights conferences, which are not animal rights conferences, they're animal welfare conferences, that occur in the States and that are parroted in places like New Zealand. It seems to be more like a big, there is all the same elements, like in these big conferences, there's all the welfareists there promoting themselves, promoting their organizations, their books, their campaigns, whatever. And, you know, there are stalls and there are vendors and all that stuff. But it seems that not that I know anything about it because I've never been to one, but it seems that the ones in the UK are a bit more like a big festival where you go outside and there's, I don't know, I've never been to one. The vegan summit that they had in LA is probably different again. I wouldn't know. But anyway, long story short, there's open debate happening now. Even at the American Animal Welfare Conference, with the year that Gary Francione went, and they had a big debate he had a debate with Bruce Friedrich, which you can find online, about welfareism versus abolition. And so there's one of the focuses, which I think is really great, of this latest ones in London, was the single issue campaigns, because finally, so, you know, slowly, vegans are finally starting to get it about single issue campaigns. They're just the thorn in the side, the bane of our advocacy is this fixation, this obsession with single issue campaigns. And all of the arguments for them are generally strawman arguments. In other words, they take a position that we don't hold and then attack that position, that non-existent position that we never said, you know, people who are opposed to single issue campaigns. But the problem is that, you know, it's hard because I've never been involved in one, a single issue campaign. I could never really understand why people couldn't see how speciesist they were. But I have to say, I've got some perspective to share now, which is interesting. I am completely opposed to single issue campaigns, and I don't think I will ever change on that. But I might have a slight more insight into why people get hooked into them, which will be good for me when I'm trying to advocate to others who are hooked into them. But it's hard to sort of get through the... It's basically, I don't know, speciesism mixed in with complete lack of knowledge about what vegan education is, because there's zero experience doing vegan education, and then there's all these strawman arguments. Like, one of the speakers at VegFest London was this guy called Tony Wardle, who is the leader. You know, he's a paid person, a career person for this organization called Viva, which is a total new welfareist organization, of course. And himself and another person called Victoria Iserman, who I don't know anything about, the organization, it's called the Canine Angels, so I imagine it's a dog, you know, about dogs. And then, so he was on the side of pro-single issues, and then Gary Francione was on the side of against single issue campaigns, of course. He basically coined the term, as far as I'm aware, in the animal movement anyway, he coined the term single issue campaigns. And also there was another person who was on with Gary Francione against single issue campaigns called Marcus Dredge. And so the debate basically, but Tony Wardle started out the debate basically with complete straw man arguments about, you know, just, it's just really, really typical. And it's just, finally people are starting to get it though. So what most people think about single issue campaigns is that you have to wake people's consciousness up, and they use the same arguments to justify welfareist campaigns. You have to wake people's consciousness up, you have to get through to people, and it's like, why are they, where does it come from that vegan campaigning for the moral person, I mean, I think I've said this in so many podcasts, but where do they get the idea that as a person standing up for the basic fundamental rights of all non-human animals, based on the sentience of all non-human animals and human animals, right? And the moral personhood, opposed to the injustice done to them all, where is it that people think that that's not going to raise somebody's conscience? Because that's what vegan advocacy is about. It's not about, hey, you're going to lose weight, you know, if you go vegan, or, you know, you're going to save water. I mean, all, you know, the water, the environmental thing is important. So and other important health issues, you know, are important. But I don't know where the way they get off. So most of the arguments against single issue, for single issue campaigns against vegan advocacy, are complete straw men and just stupid and don't make any sense. But I have to say that I wonder, a lot of it is the same for welfareist campaigning, and that's why it's so great there's so many new vegans coming along. But I have to tell you a story, because I've just been through a month that I did not predict. You know, I was really getting into my street stall. The weather was getting warm. We'd done some great street stalls in Auckland. We had a great festival at the Grey Lynn Festival. It was fantastic. But I inadvertently became a rescuer of 18 mice. And This was not planned, and I won't go into details of how it happened. I didn't go out and rescue. I'm not a hero. I just take my hat off to people who do rescue, even more now than ever, honestly. But it just, through my job, actually, these mice were uplifted, not by me or whatever, but anyway, they were at my job, and there were people who had, I mean, I'm just walking down the office, and there are these people holding mice, and I just, my heart just sank, and I just said, what, they're in a cage of mice, they had two cages, actually, and I just said, what is going on, what are you doing with those mice, and they said, well, we're going to take them to the SPCA, and I said, no, you're not, because they would have been killed, because none of them were de-sexed, and as it turned out later, two of them were pregnant, but I just said, no, I'll take them. Now, I have to admit that I did not know there was 18, I thought there was 5 or 6, and even then I was panicking. And I'm ashamed to say that I never considered fostering any other animals in my home. I always already felt I had my hands full with Buddha and Shebi, especially with Buddha being ill, and I just have one room. I don't have I don't have a lounge, or like I don't have like a proper apartment. You know what I mean? Like, it's just basically a room, and there is a kitchen, and then toilet and shower. No bathroom. It's just really basic, and I just thought, I just can't do it. But it's amazing what you find out you can do, and now I realize I can totally foster maybe no other cats or dogs, but there are other animals, right? I've rescued a couple of rabbits from the street, very short term. Luckily, one of them found a home thanks to this vet, the people at the vet where I used to clean cages in the cattery. And then the other one turned out to belong to somebody, so I just returned him to his home. But rabbits are quite a big deal to look after. You don't just stick them in a cage, and they need lots of exercise, they need room. So rabbits are not, but in terms of mice and like hamsters, or do we have hamsters in New Zealand? What are the guinea pigs? We have guinea pigs here. So I reckon I might become a guinea pig fosterer. Just saying it, because there's room on top of my closet. But anyway, oh, I'm rambling. It's been such an out of control month. So I'm at work thinking everything's just going along, and then all of a sudden there's these mice, and I'm like, no, I'm taking them, because I knew they would be killed. And it was providence, because it's such a long story. I don't know if I should talk too much about the mice. I could talk for days about the mice, but I'm trying to make a point about single issue campaigns. So let me just get to it. So I, long story short, I brought them home. Turned out there was 18, because one of the cages had 12 or 14 mice in, all of whom were babies, because this one female mice, it was a bad situation that these mice were in, and they were uplifted, and they weren't, you know, the person who had them was homeless now and could not keep them, and so they were all going to be taken to the SPCA, and they would have all been killed. So I found out after I took the cages home that there was, you know, like 18 altogether. There was actually 16, and then the next day I went in and there was two more mice in a different cage, and I said, what, there's two more? And they said, oh yeah, because they were taken home on a Friday by somebody, by two different people, to look after them over the weekend until they figured out what they were going to do. So they didn't just take them to the SPCA on the Friday, thank goodness, or I would never have been able to, yeah, take them. So, oh, I have to tell you, it's mad. Mice, I've learned so much about mice, and you know, having this situation makes me hate domestication more than ever. I hate it more than I ever did before, if that's even possible. You know, it's so wrong. It's so wrong. So there's anybody who's had mice knows, but I didn't know anything about mice. So they can fight to the death. They can cause terrible injuries to each other. And they breed very quickly. I mean, we all kind of know that. But I managed to prevent any pregnancies from occurring, and we got the two pregnant females spayed. So there was no babies. They were aborted. And yes, you know, you can write me a whole essay on that if you want, and we can debate it. But domestication is wrong, and there are no easy answers. Bringing more victims, there would have been 19 more if those two females had carried their pregnancies to terms. And everybody survived their surgeries, they're doing great, and there was because they were so small, they would escape the cages that I would get for them, and they, like, I had, you know, toes bitten off one because they bit the toes off. And I mean, it's just been an absolute insane nightmare. And I've been looking online about mice, and the more I looked, the more I hate domestication, because there's all these problems, because males will fight. They will fight to the death. They will breed, you know, and then the females, because they're all in cages, because they're all domesticated, they'll breed. And so like the female can have a litter and within 24 hours get pregnant again. 3 weeks later, have another litter. And then, and this was what happened to this poor mice, Bubbles. So her cage had 16 altogether in, most of whom were her children, including two newborn mice who were born the day that they were taken home by the people who took them home for the weekend and then brought them to work on Monday. So they were born on Friday the 20th of November, and I got the mice on Monday the 23rd of November, and then I got two more on Tuesday the 24th. That was how I got the 18 altogether. So, and then the more I was reading about it, and you know, sadly the people who know the most about mice and caring for them are breeders, you know, the breeders. And so being involved in this and going through all the nightmares of having to separate everybody out because of the risk of breeding, and because the vets, that's another story, I'll tell you a bit about that. It's definitely providence that I had to get these mice now. It was, everything was in the right, like the stars were aligned or whatever you want to believe. But the vets are not, the vets that I knew, they were specialists in small animals. They're called exotic animals. Mice are considered exotics. Not every vet cares for them, and same with birds and things like that. You know, birds and lizards and things are considered what's called exotics in the pet world. And so you have to have a specialist vet. And even they couldn't figure out the sex of some of these mice, because breeders are really good at sexing mice. Pet stores are notoriously bad. You'll go to a pet store, buy them two boys or whatever you think, and then you come home and one of them's pregnant and it was a female, because sexing them is actually not that easy. It's not as obvious, especially when they're young, and especially if you don't hold them side by side. So you'll pick a mouse up and have a look and say, yes, I think that's a boy. But because the testicles don't descend right away, and because it's all about the distance between the sort of genitalia and the tail, and it's just, you know, we're talking millimeters, you know, on the little ones. And then you'll pick up another mice and you're like, is that bigger or less distance than the one before? So unless you hold two of them up side by side. So even the vets were like, oh, I think that's a girl, I'm not really sure, just separate them just to be sure. So I had to separate them. Can you imagine? And so many cages. But anyway, we managed to get it done. And then finally, they've all now I can say, like as of last Wednesday, finally. So I adopted them on the 23rd of November, and we're talking 3 days ago now, or 4 days ago. Finally, we have them all sexed, like, you know, identified which sex they are, you know, down to the little babies who are now a month old and being weaned. But breeders are good. And then the more I was researching, because like even the vets didn't know, they're like, oh, you know, mice of the same sex usually get along, because they're not used to dealing with this situation. Vets don't deal with a situation where 18 mice, they deal with pet mice where somebody has one or two mice, and they're not breeders. So they don't deal with massive amounts of mice the way breeders do. So most of the information I was getting was offline, and it was from breeder sites about, and it was terrifying. They're like, males will fight to the death, and they will. And I, like I said, I had a little female baby sneak out of her cage in the middle of the night because she was so tiny, and I didn't know she was a girl at the time. Later on, I found out she was a girl, and I couldn't believe it. And she's the one who bit. There's a mice called Two Toes. He's actually got three toes missing. He just had to have the third one amputated. She bit his toes off. And I was reading online, that's such a common thing amongst domesticated mice and rats, is they'll bite each other's toes off. And it just, and then all of these things about just all of these problems that we cause, these, we put these animals in these terrible situation of domestication, and you're dealing with all these problems, and there's people who, you know, do it for money. But it's oh my gosh, I just hate domestications even more than I ever thought possible. But anyway, the situation has calmed down, and there's been some amazing people. I started a Facebook page. There are people adopting them. Huge shout out to Lucy Levy and her wonderful family, who took four mice in one family, which is a lot, you know, a lot of responsibility. And they've just gone all out. And these are a vegan family, and they've done heaps of other rescue. And she was the first person to step up, even after saying, you know, I've got all these other rescued animals. So just massive, massive shout out. But anyway, they've actually finally gone because, you know, I couldn't adopt them right away because there was all of the sexing and then they had to be neutered. And so it was like a month-long process, like before I could finally get them adopted. Although I had a couple who were ready within 2 weeks, I think, because the females were spayed and then the males were neutered and then they were couples. Like this was the mother and the father, you know, mice, the other mother and father, because Bubbles had already given birth to the last two babies. Thank goodness she wasn't pregnant again. We were terrified she was pregnant again because the sons will impregnate the mother once she's, you know, as soon as they hit, you know, whatever, four weeks or whatever it is, 3 to 4 weeks. Anyway, my gosh, but here we go. This is my point. Okay, thanks for listening. Thanks for listening, everybody. Here is my point. So I started to realize, because the person who had these mice should never have mice, shouldn't have any animals at all. But as an adult, this is a, you know, teenager, but considered an adult, you know, in society, she can go to any pet store and she can buy any mouse or bird, and she can buy them completely intact, as they call it. These are animals, are breedable animals. They do not desex. It's very expensive to desex mice, actually. If it wasn't for the donations, which I cannot believe how amazing people are, I didn't ask for donations, but somebody offered, and I don't know if they're listening, but they did say they didn't want to be mentioned because they're like not about that, and I'd love to mention them. But they wrote to me and said, would you like some help? And I already knew how much it was all going to cost, but I had been, I got a tax return, and I had been, for the first time in my adult life, actually saving money out of my paycheck. So I had $1,800 in the bank, which is all gone now, but that's okay. I had it. I mean, I was able to say yes to these mice because I could, which was such a relief to me. I can't imagine what I would have done if I had been how I was the whole previous few years with zero money in the bank, no savings at all, completely irresponsible. I mean, I don't make a lot of money, but I can still save a little bit, even just $100 a month. You can put it in the bank and not go out and buy some takeaway Thai vegan food or whatever. You know what I mean? So thank goodness. But I got this tax return. That's another story. That was quite a funny story. I did 5 years worth of tax return in one go because I got a $600 car bill because my brakes needed replacing. And of course I didn't have the money because I don't save money. So I was like, oh my gosh, I can't get my Warren Fitness. I have no money. And my cars are going to cost $600. And then I realized, you know, I haven't done a tax return for like 5 years. Did a tax return and I got over $2,000. So I used all of that. I used $600 of it to pay the car bill, and then the rest I just put in the bank. And thank goodness I had the money in the bank because these mice happened. Not only that, the vet, the exotics vet, there's only one in the whole of Auckland, and Auckland is a big metropolitan area, okay? It is a big city, and in terms of land distance. And they moved, brand new location, just moved. This is right before I got the mice. They just moved to a location that's literally about a 10-minute drive from my house. So Providence, right? And not only that, these people, like somebody said to them, do you want money? And I said, no, I don't. I was like, I can handle this. And then I just thought, it's going to be a lot of money. And I could have borrowed it, but I said, well, I'll just say yes for the first time in my life. When somebody offers me help, I'll just say yes. And I did. And then they donated money. It was so generous. And then I thanked them, and they said, thank, you know, you don't mention my name, but thank me. They said, we don't mind if you thank me because maybe other people will donate. And I just said, thank you to the person who donated. And then all these other people came forward and they donated a total. And at my job, they had a fundraiser because everybody knew about the mice at my job, of course. And they had a fundraiser and gave me $100. And so I got over $800 from some complete strangers as well, and people online. And they're just, you know, Facebook people, vegans, right? And I'm just shocked at how incredibly generous people are. And I just would not want to be able to pay them back or do something in return. I should do that anyway. I should just be like them, you know. And I've donated money to animal rescues before, but wow, it's amazing when it's you and it happens. So the worst is over, and I've still got some more surgeries to go, but I can do them. There's no urgency about them. There's definitely no more pregnancies, no more risk of pregnancies, and a couple of the babies are still too young to be desexed anyway, so I can just sort of save money for those. And also we got a measly pay rise from our job, 1.5%, woohoo, that's after 3 years, okay? And, well, it's the newest pay rise. It's like the after the negotiations for the latest whatever union. And it doesn't even cover my rent increase, which is happening in January, but they back paid it to July. So that gave me another lump sum. So it's all like, it was all meant to be. I was meant to rescue these mice. That's just the way it was. And I didn't go out, like I said, and do it the way some people do. So this just happened and I just cannot believe. And the stress is unbelievable of rescuing and just dealing with the domestication and the issues of the confinement and the fighting and the terrible situation these mice are in because of us. And I just, my hat goes off to rescuers even more than before. You're amazing people. And if you're not vegan, gosh, you better go vegan, because if you think it's bad what's happening to the animals you've rescued, ooh, you got to think about all the others. But wow, it was amazing experience. But what I want to say is, finally, after venting, and yep, great, thank you again for listening, it's been so stressful, that I am shocked. And, you know, I just can't, you know, you don't think about things until they can't fall in your lap. There's so much going on in the world. Now I'm flabbergasted that the pet stores can sell mice to anybody. Anybody who walks in can breed, and you take those mice home, and one of the females had 11 fetuses inside her. That's 11 new babies. And because mice are just nothing, they cost $6. I don't think they're nothing, but in the views of society, they cost $6 for one mouse. So who's going to, who's going to worry about that if your mouse gets sick or needs to go to a vet, and it has to be a specialist vet, and any surgery is specialist surgery, of course, because they're so tiny. The anesthetic is incredibly touch and go. It's very risky. Vet has to really know what they're doing. The equipment has to be specialized, you know, super specialized equipment for these tiny animals. And so so the pet shops can breed them or just get them, you know, from people walking in. Some pet shops will take mice. If I wanted to, I could have let those females have their babies and waited a month or two or 6 weeks and gone to a pet shop and said, here, you can buy these mice from me. And they would have bought them from $1. I've verified that with one pet store, not all of them, but one of them does that. And I realized, you know, I can see how a single issue campaign can begin. So if I was not an abolitionist, and if I was naive and didn't know the way the world worked in terms of non-human animals and the property status, I would have started a petition for mice to not be sold in pet stores, you know, that are intact. Like, all the males would have to be neutered, and you know, they would have to, and I would be, and I would get signatures, and because that is, and the thing that would make me do it is I'd be like, it's doable, you know, it's one thing, I can stop this situation, this is such a bad situation from happening. I hate to think what's happening to so many mice people. I hate to think what is happening to mice out there in our societies. Pet stores can sell them intact. Anybody can go to a pet store and buy one female and one male and take them home and be irresponsible, and then they'll breed and breed and breed. And if the situation gets out of control, you're going to have fights to the death. You're going to have abscesses from fighting. I had one mouse who was badly bitten. I thought he had tumors that appeared overnight, big massive tumors. Turned out to be the most horrific abscesses that you can ever imagine. We thought he was going to have surgery, but he didn't. Thank goodness, because I actually had to administer antibiotics and anti-inflammatory orally to mice, to a baby mouse and to an adult female as well, whose her surgery site got infected. That alone is just, whoa, I can't believe I had to do that, but I managed to make it. But anyway, he healed up from his abscesses and we didn't have to do surgery on them. But you know, the surgery would have cost $200 maybe, or $150, you know. If he'd had to have, you know, the abscess surgery. So I know people aren't going to do that. They would just let him die or just hope that he heals on his own, or, you know, and you can have 20 mice within, you know, a month or two. And, you know, you can't tell me that these people are taking them all to the vet to get desexed, and it's just not happening. So I'm just filled with horror now, because I knew about mice. I knew there was pet mice. I just didn't know anything about the details of the situations of pit mice. And now that I know about it, I know a lot about it. And if I wanted to, I could spend the next 5 years of my life heavily involved in a single issue campaign about pit mice. And I would convince myself that it could happen because it's just one thing. I can make this happen, you know, which is, I'm totally disagreeing with that mindset, but I'm saying I can see how people get involved personally. This is personal for me now, the mice situation. It's personal, you know. And every time I go past a pet store, I'm thinking, oh my gosh, you're selling intact mice to people. It's just really terrifying, and rats as well. And so anyway, this is probably, I just think maybe that's one of the mentalities that some people get into. It becomes very personal for them. They either have direct, you know, and they think it's something that they can get people behind them on, because I have a valid case. We have a valid case for veganism as well, by the way. Thank you very much. But there is a valid case here. I mean, this, you know, it's just every time I think about it now that I've been involved and I realize how bad things are for mice and how seriously complex they are, how, you know, they can cause such serious injury to each other. As soon as the males start to become sort of mature, and that doesn't take very long, they start to fight. And it can be really, really bad. And they can kill each other. Or at least cause terrible abscesses, or bite each other's toes off, or worse, you know. And so I can just see, like, if this was somebody else, I could have started a single issue campaign, and I would be on. I could have probably gotten in the paper about pet stores selling intact mice and how irresponsible it is, and what's happening to all these mice, and they're probably all having, you know, and you know, because I looked around New Zealand, there's no mice rescue group here. I was looking for a mouse rescue group for advice, and I couldn't find one. There's a rat rescue group in Nelson, New Zealand, by the way. Rats are very popular pets, and they're also sold intact in the pet stores. There was nothing for mice. And, you know, you look at the SPCA, where I've got two of my mice, are there. I very begrudgingly and sort of trepidation got the SPCA involved, just because I didn't know how much luck I was going to have rehoming, and I made them promise me that they wouldn't let anything happen to them, and that if they didn't get adopted, they had to give them back to me, and if they got sick and they needed vet care, they had to give them back to me. They're not allowed to kill these mice. I was like, you are not allowed to kill these mice. But the scary thing about the SPCA, and from my point of view, was that when I talked to them, they said, well, yeah, okay, fine, but you realize that if you want us to take these animals on, you have to surrender them to us. You actually have to legally surrender them, and what you do is you give them, they now become property, because we're talking about chattel property, remember, we're talking about things in the eyes of our law and society, and they become the property of the SPCA, and the SPCA becomes their owner, and they have no obligation to inform you of anything that is going on with these animals. And they say that if the animals become sick or something or cannot be adopted, they may be euthanized. Now, I understand why the SPCA does that, in terms of you're taking an animal who's being abandoned. You don't, that person who had the animal is just abandoning them, or is not responsible or caring for them, or is being neglectful, or whatever the case may be. The SPCA is like, right, we're taking this animal off your hands. She's our responsibility now, and you have nothing to do with it. Goodbye, you know, forget it. I understand that. But when you're someone like me who was desperate to get these animals adopted and was asking for their help, it's kind of like it's not really what they're for. They're not an adoption service in terms of helping somebody like me. But they very graciously agreed to do it, but I was terrified. So they still haven't been adopted, so I'm actually going to go and adopt them back. Like, I have to go through the full adoption process to get these mice back. And I'm just going to bring them back because things aren't as crazy here now. There's no more risk of injuries. Everybody's too big to escape their cages now. Well, the ones who aren't, I've managed to block off the escapes. I have got so many more gray hairs on my head. They can get out, and then, oh, thank goodness they're so tame, they don't go very far. You just find them on top of the cages, but then that's how they get their toes attacked, you know, from the other mice as well. So now that I have this whole personal involvement and this whole new knowledge, this sort of detailed knowledge of this situation that there are pet shops all over the country selling intact mice to people, mice who are basically worth nothing, who they do not have to invest any money. It's just, I just am, you know, now very, very, you know, but I'm not going to start a single issue campaign about mice. I'm going to continue on with my vegan campaigning for the, because in the current paradigm that we live, a single issue campaign about mice is pointless. Does everybody get that? It's pointless. We're talking about a world in which non-human animals are things, including mice, but not limited to mice. All of them are things. And as long as people are shoving them into their mouths 3 times a day, 7 days a week, and going and buying trinkets made out of their skin because they like the way they look, you know, we're not, nothing's going to change. So we have to address the property status. And vegans don't go and buy mice from pet shops and allow them to breed. Vegans don't do that. I mean, not if they're, well, abolitionist vegans don't do that, which is why I advocate for abolitionist veganism, okay? And so the world that we're living, you know, it does address these things. And so, but I can see how some of these, maybe that's why the virulent protestations, when we criticize the campaigns, people might take it personally. They might feel like they can, that they're actually going to make a difference or whatever. Maybe it is something they're personally involved in. So I could see how it could begin. I don't think it's ever been done before. As far as I know, there's been no petitions or, oh gosh, I don't want to give anybody ideas. Don't go out and start a single issue campaign about mice being, you know, sold intact from pet shops. Focus on vegan education, abolitionist vegan education, and the moral personhood of non-human animals. Okay, that's how we're going to change the world. But there's a couple of arguments about single issue campaigns. And now finally, I mean, there's just been all these public debates now, like the one I told you about at VegFest, where prominent leaders of welfarist groups are being taken to task, defend themselves publicly and their campaigns to their volunteers and to the animal sort of community, animal people community, publicly. I mean, that's a good thing. You know, it's not a bad thing. Everybody, this is what needs to happen. We have to change this welfarist movement into an abolitionist movement. We have to. And this is incredible developments that these are happening. So there's so much information out there. I mean, Gary Fitzgerald's been running about single issue campaigns on his blog for years, and talking about it in interviews and all those kinds of things. But it was always one-sided in terms, like, he would talk about it and everything, and then everybody else would just say all these straw man arguments, like, you know, you have to, like I'll go over a couple of what Tony Wardle said. He basically started out by saying that, you know, you can't, like, there are people out there who are struggling to pay the bills, and they're not gonna respond to you know, it's much better to just show them a horrible, gory video expose and then tell them to cut down on their meat eating than it is to talk to them. And he was making fun of the language, like, moral baseline, property relations, sentience, da da da. You have to talk to them in their own language. Well, Tony, do you not recognize that those are concepts that have to be articulated in advocacy? So you, as a person who is allegedly wanting to educate others, ought to be educating yourself on those terms, and then you can educate others on those terms in their own language, as you put it, if need be. So I talk to all kinds of different people at my street stall, from, you know, capitalist elite white businessmen to homeless street kids who are Māori or Pacific Island, okay? And the concepts and the content of the discussion does not change. If I recognize that I am For one thing, I have people asking me what sentience means, not because they're stupid, but because they haven't been told what it means, okay? And you know what I do? I explain to them, Tony, what it means. And they're curious to know, and they're glad to learn it. And they appreciate it, and they say, okay, now I get you. And that's education, Tony. But if they don't grasp that, or if it doesn't work, then yes, we will talk about it. We will use other terminology, such as they can feel pain, they can feel pleasure, they can feel hurt when they're hit, they bruise. I mean, you know, that's what education is. So it just makes no sense to me for someone to say what we've been saying all along, which is you got to educate people and you have to talk to them and you have to be creative about it, and then to say, your way isn't going to work because you have to educate people and you have to talk to them and you have to be creative about it. And we're just like, huh? And he even had the nerve to say without a concrete plan. I can't remember his exact wordings, but he said, you know, you're criticizing us. I mean, he's taking it very personally because it's his career. And, you know, he's been dedicating himself to this too. I think he's like, I don't know how long he's been, you know, a part of this organization, but I imagine it's quite a long time. So I understand that as well. You're right, he is defending himself, you know, personally, because he's taking it very, very personally. He said, you know, you criticize us with no evidence. Well, yes, there's plenty of evidence. Just look around you and look at what the state of the situation for non-human animals, and then ask yourself if the welfare advocacy for the last 200 years has done anything. And then he said, you don't even have like a solution. And I just thought that was so insulting. Like, how dare you go into a debate without even having the slightest, tiniest inkling of knowledge of who you're debating and what you're debating about and what their position is? That is so disrespectful. And you know what really annoys me about a lot of these people is you can tell because of their straw man arguments and their completely ignorant statements about our position that they haven't read one single thing that Gary Francione has written or talked about. They might have seen things that others have said about him. They're listening to what the misrepresentations are about the work, and then they're attacking that, hence the straw man. And it's just a huge waste of everybody's time. But no, I shouldn't say that. It's very valid that there's these debates happening. So it's a very exciting time. I don't know what's going to happen in New Zealand because I just am very, I don't get involved, and I am not going to any kind of conference here. But I think that things are changing here as well because, you know, I sort of have, the last month I've been doing nothing but, I won't even, you know what I've been doing. I still just do my stress tool, and I'm noticing a difference, as you say, every day. As I've said over the years, every day I notice a difference at the stall. It's unbelievable. But I do occasionally pop around and have a little look-see at what's happening in New Zealand and the comments that are being made. Most importantly, I examine the comments that are being made by other animal advocates, vegans, on social media and on public platforms, and I compare them to how it was, you know, a few years ago. So, like, there was a big expose done by SAFE, the welfarist movement group here in New Zealand. Their new campaign is about, they had an expose about truck drivers who were loading they're called bobby calves in New Zealand, and they were being, I didn't watch it, but we all know the story of what happens to these animals because they're property, and then there was an expose about it, and then it's all about the treatment, and then of course the farmers are saying, well, it wasn't even the farmers doing that, it was the truck drivers, and there's all this stuff, and then, you know, and then the really thing that really annoys me is that because we, you know, unfortunately, SAFE have started mentioning veganism. I regret that now. I do regret that because they're mixing it up with their useless welfarist campaigning and their speciesism, and that's a problem. I wish they never mentioned veganism and associated it with SAFE. It's doing more harm than good. But whatever, too late, and we just have to roll with the flow and go with the punches and just see, you know, just adjust. We constantly have to adjust, and that's just the nature of every social movement, I guess. But they're coming, like a couple of farmers came onto my page. They saw the word vegan and then they just assumed I was all a part of this campaign with Safe, because, you know, Safe is now saying, well, we're vegans, and then, you know, which they never used to do, really. I don't even think they ever even used to talk about the fact that they were vegan, because they were just too special and the riffraff just couldn't handle that, you know, sort of exalted information. And I don't know. But they're coming, the farmers coming on and saying, you know, we don't, what do you think of farm? We don't treat our animals like that. And I was like, look, I don't have anything to do with that money-raising campaign that they're doing about treatment. We focus on use. I don't support Safe. I don't deal with that campaign because we focus on use. We do not focus on treatment. And it's kind of, yeah, but they haven't really come to my page that much. My page is not really, you know, a very active page. But bottom line is that what I'm doing is I'm looking at the other advocates, the new, especially new vegans, and they are commenting in ways that is warming the cockles of my heart, because I see them and they're saying, it doesn't matter how these calves were treated, they still would have been taken from their mothers and they still were going to be slaughtered. So this is terrible what's happened to them. But the whole reason they're even in this situation is because nobody's vegan and you need to go vegan. And I'm just like, oh, hallelujah. That's just such a beautiful thing to see. It's happening. You know, it's happening. And the more people who say it, the more other people will have the gumption and the strength and again be galvanized to say it themselves. They'll feel like there's safety in numbers. So that's a good thing too. So things are definitely changing. I had like such a clear, I was so ready to do this podcast right before the mice came along. I was so going to do a podcast like on the single issue campaign. I was going to attack one by one every argument that Tony Wardle made and all these people. But it's actually already happening out there. And but what I will say is that I don't agree with, one of the things that I object to is when people say, well, I'm going to go to this big single issue campaign event, whether it's live export or maybe there'll be one in New Zealand, maybe they'll have a protest down the street about the fact that these calves were hit with hammers before they were on the trucks or whatever, you know, the horrible things were done to them. And then there might be some people who say, well, I'm going to go along to this and I'm going to take abolitionist flyers and I'm going to promote abolition there at this big welfareist rally and I'm going to take advantage of all the numbers of people who are there. I actually disagree with that. I don't think that you should do that. I think that it's more effective to just go as far away as you can from this single issue campaign. Distance yourself and abolition from it as far as you can. For one thing, when you are in a, it's almost like a mob mentality a bit. So when you are in a big welfareist event that is dominated by welfareism and dominated by a welfareist thought process and run by welfareists, there is almost like a mob mentality there of welfareism. And it's going to be, you know, I think you're kidding yourself a bit if you think that you are going to go and, I mean, unless you are allowed to actually have a debate in which they respond to you the way Gary Francione did when he went to the Animal Welfare Conference in, I think it was 2013, where he debated Bruce Friedrich. Was it 2014? I'm losing track of time. My life is just flying past. I'm going to blink and I'll be 75. But, you know, unless you're sort of given a platform basically and you're actually legitimized in a way, because finally they have to legitimize. They've been trying to avoid doing that. Oh, here's Buddha. Hi, baby. Hi. Buddha. She can't hear me. Hi. I just have to clap my hands. Yes, I know. I know you're there. She's just had something to eat and now she's having a drink of water. She just vocalizes. She's fine. She just does that. And she's deaf, so she does it very loud. But what was I saying? Yeah, so I just don't agree with going to any welfareist event. If you're going to take the time and go, and, you know, don't be fooled by thinking, oh, there's this big crowd of people. I mean, I'm never going to get a big crowd of people like that. You're not going to get a big crowd of people like that yet as an abolitionist. You're not. You're going to be lucky if you get 10 people to come along to your event. So just go out in the streets or wherever you can and just go to a neutral place. Don't stand outside a butcher Because then you're targeting meat, and then you're reinforcing this terrible, terrible paradigm that we have that meat is worse and that other animal products are less bad, and that, you know, then you have all the vegetarians going past and saying, yeah, meat, you know, and you totally reinforce this whole terrible hypocrisy of vegetarianism. Just go somewhere neutral. And not outside a fur shop, not outside a butcher. Don't go to some speciesist rally. And no, you're not going to have 1,000 people with bullhorns chanting and stuff like that for you to sort of. But just, it's much more worth it. Just, you know, work on those, on the people that you meet, and this, and there'll be people walking past you. And if you go to the same, on the same day as whatever big rally it is, like I accidentally one day. Well, I didn't accidentally. I went and did my street stall, as I do whenever I can, randomly on a Saturday. It's not every Saturday. It's not even every week. It's not even every month sometimes. I just do it when I can. And it just so happened that right behind me on the same day, SAFE, this animal welfare organization that I'm telling you about in New Zealand, had this big corpse holding event where they stand in a square and hold the corpse of animals who they have. I don't know where they get the corpses from. I think it's from maybe slaughterhouses or farms or. And then they all stand around looking solemn and playing music and looking dramatic and getting their picture in the paper. And then they had a big, and then they had this recording or somebody gave a speech about the battery egg campaigns. It was all about welfareism and it was all about cage-free eggs, which was their current campaign at the time. So I think they were holding corpses of chickens, I think it was. Who were battery hens, probably. So I had no idea that this was going to be happening that day. I really need to pay more attention, seriously, to what's going on around me. But I'm just, I have my faults, and that's one of many. So there I am, and all of a sudden I see all this stuff behind me in the square, in the actual Aotea Square, the big square behind me. I'm not allowed in the square to do my advocacy. But SAFE is a national organization, and they're a charity, a registered charity, and I'm sure they either paid money or they got a special thing to do it that day, or maybe they just did it, I don't know. But there I am, and I'm thinking, great, you know, I want people to know I have nothing to do with this, what's going on behind me. So I just did my stall, and I tried very hard to let people know that I didn't have anything to do with that organization. I just come here. I said, I come here when I can. I didn't even know about this. And I said, I'm here to talk to you about veganism. I'm not here to talk to you about battery eggs. And you know, it was fine. But I mean, I really, really wish people, like, we need to stop relying on the welfare. They do have all the people. They have thousands of people come to their events because they're these big corporate charities, and they have full-time employees who make a living, get paid to organize events and do publicity. We don't. The solution is not for us to turn into that, though. No, 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 no. The solution is to accept the fact that it's not going to be big bonanzas and heaps of publicity and heaps of people, that it's just going to be you and a couple of other people on a street corner. Trust me, that's revolutionary. And you are making a difference. You are starting. You are building towards the crowds and more people. One of the really inspiring things that I listen to a lot is Chris Hedges and Noam Chomsky. And Chris Hedges often quotes a figure from the anti-war movement, I think, the anti-Vietnam War movement. Or was it Noam Chomsky who did? Gosh, I'm so bad at keeping my facts straight. But it was basically the concept that I'm trying to relay is they started out with about 100 people in this square protesting the war. They were completely outnumbered. They were completely unsupported, but they were all there because they believed in it. And 2 years later, it was 100,000 people. Okay, now that was obviously, you know, I'm not saying we're going to go from 100 people in abolitionist vegan activities in the world, you know, in a country to 100,000 in 2 years. But what I'm trying to say is stop riding on the coattails of the welfareist to their speciesist event. For one thing, I think you're legitimizing it by going along. The only way the only time you should be going along is to do what Gary Francione did, which is to stand up and denounce it all. And that's not an easy thing to do if you don't have like he was, you know, invited to come and do that. And it was understood that he was going to debate. But it's like, you know, like these people who stand up and scream in the Chipotle restaurants, which is like this Mexican restaurant in America, you know, that you're going along and then you're going to sort of it might feel good at the time, but it's actually, I think it's, you're much more effective if you just accept that we're small potatoes right now. We just are, but it's growing. I mean, look around you, look at what's happening. Look at what is happening in the world. Any new vegans who are by any chance listening to this, if I even have anybody listening, because there's so many new podcasts and all that stuff, and I just haven't been in the game as much anymore, and I just say the same things anyway now. I don't think I'm saying anything original in my podcast now. If I ever did, you know, I'm just basically promoting the abolitionist approach from Gary Francione's theories. But what I just want to say is, things are really different now. And so if you look around and say, oh, it sucks because there's only like 5 abolitionists in my whole school, I'm like, you used to only be 5 abolitionists in the whole world, you know? So wake up. This is, you're part of the change. And you have to just do your little thing and just make it really good. Make it consistent and the word will spread and you will get more support. And I'd rather have an incredible event or an incredible situation where I'm having really groundbreaking connections with people, even if it's only 3 or 4 people, then being in part of a big mindless crowd about species that's reinforcing and perpetuating speciesism and the property status. Now, I know that the people will be going along and say, yeah, but I have one-on-one conversations with people at these rallies and I give them abolitionist literature. And I'm like, if you can do it there, you can do it on the street. You can do it at a non-event. You can do it away from the welfarist event. It's hard because you have to do all the work, because you can't rely on the welfarists to do all the publicity and then you just show up with your abolitionist flyers and take advantage of all of their welfare supporting people and their welfarist controlled event. Yeah, I'm sorry, you actually have to do quite a bit of work. And it is, you know, work and, you know, but I mean, it gets to be more rewarding the longer you do it and you will find help. You know, I don't do it alone anymore. It's not like there's a huge crowd of us. Some, mostly just one or two, I should say. Otherwise, one would be alone. But it's, you know, there are people who are willing to do the work. But, you know, I don't think I'm ever going to convince people to not go along, because they'll just say, well, there's all these people there. They're all in the one place at the same time. It's all about other animals. They're all there because they care about animals. And I'm like, you know what? You can go stand on the street corner in the middle of your city or your town and you can find so many people walking past you who care about animals. So many. Okay? They're just not at some big xenophobic or speciesist anti, you know, live export, you know, rally or whatever the case may be. Oh gosh, I hope I'm making sense, because I think this might be quite controversial and I just don't agree with it. I just don't think we should be doing it. And we need to just accept that we are at the beginning still. Things are changing rapidly, but we are still, in the grand scheme of things, we are really still at the beginning. We are still at the beginning. The first 10 years can legitimately be said to be the beginning. And we're only up to year like 5, okay? So, and look at the difference that we've already made. So, forget these big species as welfarist extravaganzas. Let them get on with it and you go do your thing and you do it in a neutral place. That's my recommendation. You know, there was an event here, which I'm really grateful because somebody referred me to the event and it was a genuine referral. It was an actual animal event. And like I do these, when I'm talking about, it was like a festival, like a one day festival, you know, like I do the Greyland Festival, which we did, on the 28th of November. That was after I had sort of had the mice land in my lap. So it was pretty crazy weekend for me. But, we do other festivals. We're doing the Eco Festival, but I don't do any, like we went to this animal festival and it was mostly about adoption and, well, it was run by adoption and a lot of it had to do with adoption and fostering. It was run by these cat rescue organizations who do a lot of fantastic work. They do fostering, they do TNR, you know, trap, neuter, release, and all of this amazing stuff, and they help feral cat colonies and they just do this amazing work. But it was an animal event, so it was just dominated by welfarists. We were surrounded by welfarists. There was somebody walking around in a safe chicken suit promoting the, at the time, which this was 2 years ago now, so it was the Safe Cage-Free Egg campaign. That was the campaign that was running. And I don't want to be associated with that. And all of the welfarers there were, they just feel like, I don't want to legitimize them. I don't support what they do. I oppose what they do. I oppose it. I'm not neutral at all about that. So I just think, suck it up and realize that you're going to be just, you're going to feel like the sort of ragtag, you know, poor cousin or whatever you call it. Well, the reason that they have these big extravaganzas and these big, these big rallies where they have tens of thousands of people in Australia for the live export or whatever it is because they are so status quo. They feed into existing prejudices and reinforce them, and they capitalize on all that to gain money for themselves so they can pay themselves to do more PR work, to organize more of these fundraising campaigns for themselves. They work full-time doing this. We have full-time jobs. And we do our advocacy on the side. But trust me, it's not, we don't want to work towards where we're career people, you know? It's not gonna work. Grassroots means grassroots and accepting the fact that you're the roots, you're the ground bit, you're the bit that nobody sees, you're the bit that is underneath all of the big tall waving pieces of grass all above you with their big fancy, you know, and all their people and their big crowds and they feel like they've made such a success because they had so many people show up, and we're there in the shade under the roots, the little roots, you know, of our little grass patch. But that's where we have to, it's where we are right now, and we are making a difference, because without roots, grass will not grow. So we are going to do it. So just give it a go. Don't sit around and wait for the welfarers to organize something so you can go along and promote abolition. Make something happen, even if it seems to you to be so minusculely small. You know what? You could be the person that advocates to another person who turns out to be one of the most incredibly productive and creative and active abolitionist vegan advocates the world has ever seen. Because there are people out there who are so full of energy, so full of creativity. And there are tons of them. And you know what they're all doing right now? They're working for the welfarists, okay? So a lot of that is because they want the glory and because it's all this, you know, they've got the stars in their eyes and it is all the extravagance. I mean, one of the things that broke my heart a few times when I was at my stall is I'd have these young people come running over and they'd be all excited and they'd say, oh, what's your next event? What do you, you know? And I swear they would be disappointed that I wasn't going to say, well, you know, next week we're going to all stand up and hold a corpse and the TV camera's going to be there filming us, or we're going to paint ourselves with red paint and lie naked on styrofoam under plastic and, you know, I mean, we're going to go with bullhorns and I don't know. I just, they seem to be disappointed where I said, well, this is what we do. This is what you're looking at it. This is the event. I'm going to do it in a couple of weeks. Are you coming? And they never came. It wasn't exciting enough for them. But if you really want to do, if you really do want to do street theater, like street theater, you know, has its place in a social movement, legitimate street theater, not speciesist ones, then do it, you know, but just make it abolitionist and don't trivialize it though. Don't trivialize the issue. Don't dress up in suits and don't exploit women. You know, I'm so sick of this. Well, women have to get naked and get their breasts out and pretend that they're being milked, or they have to, you know, exploiting women is not part of any social justice movement that's against oppression. So this just, we just, I think, you know, as I'm saying this now, I'm just thinking of all of the people all over the world who I've seen do incredible creative vegan, abolitionist vegan advocacy. They're setting up tables and stalls and informations all over the world, some on a very regular basis. Damon McDonald in Australia does it seems every week. He's just unstoppable, and it does, you do make a difference. I have seen light bulbs go off. Just ask, if you don't believe me, ask the people who've done the stall with me. There are like five, but they exist. There are people who've done it with me, and they've seen with their own two eyes, and they've participated in it, and they've seen the incredible connections people make, and the light bulbs going off in people's, and you just can see it happening, and you're like, bingo, because most people do care about animals. Most people have never even been given the opportunity to even think clearly about these issues because they're so confused and blinded with welfareism and speciesism being reinforced by these campaigns. So, we'll just stick at it and forget the single issue campaigns because you can reach people by campaigning for veganism. You can wake up their consciousness, and it is ludicrous to me to say that you have to go to people and completely neglect to mention veganism and anything to do with animal rights and just talk about cutting down on meat and then expect that person, or show them a horrible video of a cow being brutalized on a truck, and then say, you know, you can cut down on dairy, or you can go dairy free, and then say, okay, so that's going to work. But then coming along to talk to us, where we talk about all animal use, including the brutalization of calves, but that's just one of many, and just the general, they're not stupid. You know, one of the funny things that Tony Water said was after he, you know, so ironic, like after he said, he actually was very classist and said, you know, try telling a single mum about sentience and stuff like this. And so he goes on to be completely elitist and classist. And then he comes around, and then later on in his speech, he said, people aren't stupid. And I'm just like, oh my gosh, are you even listening to yourself? People aren't stupid, and they can be talked to, and you can explain things to them. And I didn't know what sentience was myself, and I had to have it explained to me, and I looked it up. And then what I did is I actually, because I knew that I wouldn't be the only one, I have a printout, and it was just from Wikipedia, no big deal, but I had a printout of sentience versus sapience, because a lot of people mix sapience up with sentience. Just Google them both and you'll see what I mean, because I didn't know about sapience either. And I had it as a flyer. And when I used to lug this big, I used to have this big display stand, which I stopped taking ever since it almost fell onto a baby's pram in the wind once. But I had a sign that says, you know, sentience is all that matters. To be a member of the... No, that's Gary Francione's direct quote. Sentience is all that matters to be a member of the moral community. That is the abolitionist approach, basically, in a nutshell. But I had ones is that sentience is all that matters, and then I would had a thing saying, what is sentience? Please take one. And then I had the definition underneath, because I know that people... But that's what I'm there for. That's what you're there for. You're there to explain these concepts to people because nobody's ever done it before. And then you know what? The word becomes well-used, and people do, you know, people do recognize what it means because it becomes part of the dialogue. So stop being so elitist, you know, people. So you can wake people up. So you're telling me you got to show them a video of a calf being brutalized, and that's the only way they're going to cut down or whatever you want them to do. And yet talking to them about veganism and just waking them up to the fact that all animals are actually brutalized and slaughtered, and even though they know it because they're eating the corpses, you know, you kind of wake them up to that. And you're going to tell me they're not going to make changes? Like, for the billionth time, we don't say they're going to go vegan overnight. We say that it is up to us what argument we make, and then people will react accordingly. And so I know I've met people at the stall, and it is disappointing. I want every single person to say, oh, I'm going vegan right now. Of course I do. But I know it doesn't happen because it hasn't happened. It doesn't happen that way. Whether I like it or not, it doesn't happen that way. People do say, I'm really going to think about these things. I think I'm going to cut down and we just keep repeating to them, but we don't turn to them and say, you said you're going to cut down. Well, don't do anything then. Go eat more meat because it's all or nothing. If you're not going to go vegan right now, then don't do anything, which is what people seem to think we say. No, we just keep encouraging them. We just say, you know, you don't have to consume any animal products, you know, and they're going to go away and do what they're going to do. But you can't seriously believe that by doing vegan advocacy and promoting, you know, unequivocal veganism about the moral, and just the fact that animals are used and that they're brutalized as a matter of course, and that they're slaves and that they're sentient property, which is wrong, and all this stuff, that people don't go away and make the same kind of changes or even more changes than they would when you show them some fundraising expose video, put your hand out for a donation and then say, try going meat free for a week or whatever the case may be, or you need to cut down. You know, you don't tell them to cut down. Anybody knows that less is better, you know, is less harmful than more being more harmful. So they come to those conclusions on their own. If they decide that they want to do less harm rather than no harm, well, that's really sad for them. Eventually, I hope they decide that they want to do no harm. Wanting to do no harm is what veganism is. Being able to do zero harm is impossible. But wanting to do it is what makes you a vegan. Wanting to do no harm. And then you do as little as you, you know, as little harm as you possibly can. And the basic fundamental first step of that is to be vegan. That's just common sense. And we get it, so we just have to help other people to get it. So like I always tell people, it's the decision. Make the decision that you want to go vegan. Make the decision that you want to live your life without harming others. And then you act accordingly and you do the very best that you can. And some people don't make that decision right away. They say, well, I want to do less harm. You know, I don't want to do no harm, but I want to do less. And then they go away and then they do whatever they think it is that's helping them to do less. And what we try to make them realize is it's you can actually strive to do no harm. That's what you should be striving for. The first step to opposing rape is to not rape anybody, right? The first step to opposing the exploitation of non-human animals is to not exploit them yourself. So it's all basically very fundamental and very, very simple to explain. But because we were brought up so speciesist and we were brought up so welfaristy, the most important thing to do is educate yourself on the abolitionist approach to animal rights. Read the books. Oh my gosh. Okay, final announcement and then I'm done. Gary Francione and Anna Charlton have written a new book, and it's all about the abolitionist approach to animal rights. In fact, it's called Animal Rights, the Abolitionist Approach. So I'm just going to plug that book now because it's really fantastic. I remember when I interviewed them about Eat Like You Care, I did a big long interview with Gary and Anna, and I asked them, I said, when are you going to write a handbook, a similar handbook, you know, for welfareists, like answering all the common questions, you know, like chapter one, you know, you don't care about the animal suffering now, or, you know, chapter two, we have to awake people's consciousness, chapter three, the world isn't going to go vegan overnight. I was like dying for them to happen. Now, I'm not saying that, you know, they already had this book in the works, and when I asked them that, and I said, "When you know, can you please write a welf, you know, an sort of like an anti-welfarist handbook, you know, argument thing, like you do for Eat Like You Care with the food arguments against, you know, the veganism?" They laughed and said, "Oh, we've already got a book that we're writing," and I'm guessing it was this one. So it's basically called Animal Rights: The Abolitionist Approach, which is now worldwide recognized as a legitimate movement. And, of course, you know, unstoppable as it is. And it's basically the six principles of the abolitionist approach to animal rights. And they go into it. And those alone sort of refute a lot of the welfarist, sort of attempts at discrediting the abolitionist approach. Anyway, but yeah, I just want to say, I can't believe I almost forgot to announce it. So yeah, the book is available now. You can buy the paperback already. It is available on Kindle or ebook. You don't need a Kindle. You know, it's just an electronic version of the book, and you can read it on any device or whatever. And but I'm going to get the hard copy, of course. And it's an amazing cover. Sue Coe is an artist who does very powerful imagery about a lot of it is about animal rights, and it's a wonderful cover. It's very arresting. And the back cover is just as good. So I'll post a link. Please consider. It's another stocking stuffer, as they call it. It's another small, you know, it's a condensed book. It's the same size almost as Eat Like You Care. So now we have two books. We've got Eat Like You Care, which is for all vegans. To use as a tool for your common questions that you're going to get from every single person on the street about veganism. It's mostly about diet, the objections in that respect. And then this will help you with when you're trying to convince your welfarist acquaintances to ditch welfarism and jump onto the abolitionist bandwagon and our little affairs and be the grassroots rather than the big superficial grass that's just waving around pointlessly. And so that's the new book. It was only released like last week, and this week things have slowed down for me with the mice. I've adopted four. I have six more going for adoption as soon as two of them recover from their one had his toe amputated, his final toe, because it was badly bitten and the bone was sticking out. and he's recovering from that, but it's almost done. And then the other two girls just got spayed. We weren't sure if they were pregnant, but they're not, thank goodness. So they got spayed anyway. So they're never going to be pregnant. And they are going to another home. And then there's two boys who were already neutered, and it's very hard to reunite boys. And they are reunited and they seem to be going well, so fingers crossed that they don't, because it can change too. Like, you can put them together. This is what I've read online anyway, and I have sort of seen it happen with the four mice that I adopted, because, and the relationship's dynamic, I mean, they're stuck in a tiny cage, you know. Anytime you take anybody, I don't care who they are, and you stick them in a cage, you're going to cause, there's just going to be problems. So the dynamic can change and things can go wrong. So I'm keeping an eye on the two boys until at least Tuesday before I send them off to their new home. But that'll be six more mice adopted. That's 10 altogether, which takes me down to only 8 mice, which is nothing compared to 18. So I'm actually got my life back a bit. But yeah, I just want to also, again, finally have a huge shout out to people who do rescue. And if you're not vegan, go vegan. It's just common sense. So anyway, it's so good to do a podcast again. I've just got my energy back, and it's a beautiful summer, and I can't wait to do another street stall. Everything's been on hold for the last month, obviously, but we'll be back into it in the new year. And it won't be outside a circus or outside a fur shop or outside a meat or outside McDonald's. It'll just be in amongst it all, because it's all the same as each other. We're just there. We're actually outside Aotea Square, which is a big open space, but there's animal products all around us every single day. That's the way the world is at the moment. And it's an incredible experience to do. Just think how important it is that you do it as best you can, which whatever, maybe not, you know, I know not everybody can do a street stall in their city. I know that they just don't have the means. They don't have the money. They don't have the resources. They don't have the place. They don't have a safe space to do it. I understand that, but there are things that you can do, and there's lots of creative ideas out there. But the most important thing is, if you're doing welfareism, then you're doing something. So don't tell me you can't do, I haven't got the resources to do anything, because you're already doing something. It's just that you're using the welfareists. You're just, they're providing all the resources for you. So, okay, maybe you don't have your own, but you know, you can, you've got your voice. You've always, always, always got your voice, and nobody can take that away from you. If you're not, like, if you have a speech, you know, where you actually don't have a voice and you can only use written words, then you have written words. And if you have to use pictures, you can use pictures, but I don't recommend graphic imagery, because you want to draw people in to you. Anyway, that's a whole nother podcast. So thank you so much for listening, everybody. If you live in Auckland, New Zealand, I'm going to have some more mice that will need homes, because I'm not going to keep 8 of them, although I could. I definitely think 18 is a very bad idea. It's very stressful for the mice. They don't get enough attention. They can smell each other, which aggravates them, because their cages are so close together and they're so territorial, and it's just a bad scene. But I think I'm definitely keeping the smallest boy, because he's so gentle. His name's actually Gentle Boy, and his mother, the mother of most of them, the one who was just used as a baby machine. I'm keeping them, because I don't want to put them through any more stress. But I would like to find homes for the others, just so that they can not be surrounded by. And also, they're sort of on top of a dresser, like the cages are sort of piled on top of each other, because that's the only place I have that's safe from the cats. And anyway, I don't have any room here really. But so if you're in Auckland, there will be mice ready for adoption. I have a Facebook page. It's called 18NZ Mice. The ones who are going to be ready for adoption are not ready yet, because two of them have only just been weaned. They were the ones that were born the day they were uplifted. They're both girls. I will be getting them spayed, because I just don't agree with giving away intact, as you call it, animals to people, unless you can really, really trust them. And I know that the three females that I gave to Lucy are going to be fine. I have complete faith in Lucy. But getting the boys neutered, because otherwise aggression is just out of control. You just need to get the boys neutered if you want them to have a good life as the domestic animal. These are domestics, pets we're talking about. They're so tame. Like, I remember one person at work said to me, why don't you just take them out into a field and just let them all go? And I said, you know, they wouldn't survive. You don't understand what domesticated animals are. Like, I'm telling you, these mice, like, I'm really grateful they behave this way, because they do, they just, the escapes were so nerve-wracking. Like, I would come home from work and I would see a mouse on top of the cage and I'd just be like, oh, but they don't go anywhere. I mean, they wouldn't just, like, you know, you would think if you were locked in a cage, you would just take off running and try to find the nearest door. No, they just hang around their cage, or they might go to the next cage, and then you have the problems of the fights and the attacks. But they just don't run away, domestic mice. So if you were to take these mice and put them in a... that would just be so brutal. I just can't even... But anyway, I set them straight on that. So in about a month and a half, maybe, I've got two more boys who need to be neutered. They are still young, and they were very young, and they haven't been neutered yet. And then I've got the two girls who are also very young. And I'm hoping, although it depends on their personalities, that one of the boys will live with one of the girls, and one of the other boys, and the other boy will live with the other girl, and they'll be safe together. It's kind of safer for either girls to live together, or you can try a neutered male with a female. But even that doesn't always work, because I had to take Scooter out of Bubbles. Bubbles is the mother, because he was being too aggressive to her, and she was his mama. So he ended up going with his brother, and he's now being dominated by his brother, but the situation is under control. They have to work out their own dynamics. You just have to make sure it's a safe dynamic, that you're not having really severe abuse going on. And it seems to be working out. So... long story short, I'll have some more mice ready for adoption, but they're not ready yet. But I do have two mice who really need a home. Their names are Lefty and Big Daddy. Big Daddy is, I'm pretty sure, is the father of a heck of a lot of these mice. And his wife, Lefty, was pregnant. She had 11 fetuses, which did not see, because I chose to get her spayed, and it turned out she was pregnant. And that was a decision I made. And she was aborted during the spaying. And she has recovered fully. She's very healthy and happy. He was neutered. They're very healthy and happy. They're in the same cage. They need a home. They're very tame. They're very friendly. They love each other. They want to be together. They're completely ready to be adopted. They're very healthy. They're still very young. I would say at the most they were 3 months old. At the most. And they're at the SPCA, but I'm going to go and try to bring them home. If they haven't been adopted by the end of this week, I'm coming back to get them, because I think it's only fair. My situation has improved. Things aren't going to be as bad. I'm going to adopt six more by Tuesday, Wednesday. That'll free up some more space. And then I can free the SPCA up, because the SPCA has got full of crisis animals who don't have somebody hovering around saying, I'll take them back. You know, they're desperate. So I think it's time for me to not use the resources of the SPCA for this anymore, and to get them back. But they really did help me. It was such a big help just to have one cage out of the house and two more mice, less mice to deal with. It was a huge help. But they do need a home. They need a home now. So if you have it in your heart, or if you have, you know, if you're able to adopt and you live in Auckland, New Zealand, please go to my Facebook page, 18NZMice. It's just the numbers 18 and then the letters NZ and then mice, all one word. And you'll see the photos of Lefty and Big Daddy at the SPCA. And you can contact the SPCA directly, and they will just put you through the adoption. You know, you just sign the forms, and there might be a small fee, you know, to pay. I did tell them that they couldn't give the cage away because I was so short of cages, because I had everybody separated. But now they can. You can have the cage that they have. They have a cage that I gave them in, and you can have that cage. So you don't have to buy a cage. Just please reuse the cage. So if you can, and you can give a home, they're very easy to take care of. And you won't be going off to the vet and spending hundreds of dollars, as long as you keep their cages clean, you know, and don't introduce strange mice who attack them, you know, and things like that. They're healthy. You just keep them clean, keep them fresh water. They're very, you can do it. And so if you have the in your heart, and please go to my Facebook page and offer those to a home, because they are waiting for a home. They need a home. Okay. Well, anyway, thank you so much for listening again, and you know, keep up all the great vegan advocacy, and let's hope that the back cover of the of Gary Francione and Anna Charlton's new book, Animal Rights, The Abolitionist Approach, which is non-human animals, the sun rising over a vegan world and non-human animals dancing around it. Let's try to make that happen. Do everything you can as long as you've got a breath in your body. Okay, I'll be back. Thanks for listening. Oh, and Happy New Year, because this is the last podcast for the year. So Happy New Year, and I'll see you in 2016. Ciao.